Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 244. As always, you can get in touch with us so easily. Just send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You could follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowissogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in thisshowissogay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. An incredible show for you this week with not one, but two amazing guests. Let's get started with the first one. Robert Hebert is the Senior Director of Audience Development and Consumer Marketing for Hear Media. Hear Media, the leading producer and distributor of news and entertainment media for the LGBT community worldwide. Last week, Hear Media and video streaming platform Vimeo partnered on a new initiative to spotlight the groundbreaking work being created by LGBT filmmakers, and we are going to talk all about it. But first, Robert, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you, Ken. Good to be here.
Have you yourself struggled with your last name?
That's a great question. No.
Okay, there you go. All right, you're kind of used to it at this point.
I am. Yeah, I've been called Herbert or Hebert or Hey There. You know, just call me.
Okay, that's all he wants. Just call him, folks. I love it. I love it. We have so much ground to cover. Robert, are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
All right. So I'm seeing a background in creative marketing. Is that, because before we even talk about Hear Media, we have to talk about you. Is that a fair thing that I'm seeing, that creative marketing is in your background?
That is right. Perfect. Good place to start. Yes, I started in cable TV launch marketing, actually. And after a couple of years working on brands like Pride Vision, which was a gay cable network out of Canada, and Q Television Network, which is the world's first gay cable network that imploded about 2 months after launch.
Nice.
I liked the marketing part. Felt like I wanted to be more creative and actually went back to school, to the School of Visual Arts to study graphic and web design, and then sort of relaunched my career in creative and marketing. And yeah, been a fun road.
I'm seeing some years spent in Buffalo, which is not even like a metaphor. You were actually in Buffalo.
I was actually in frigid Buffalo, which now apparently is a super hip city.
Nice.
Definitely thought it had potential back in the 90s, but yeah, not my favorite chapter. College was great. Spent a year studying abroad to sort of escape Buffalo and see the bigger world out there. And I'm really glad I did that.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love encouraging my students to go abroad. Where did you go abroad?
So I went to London because I was too scared. I didn't trust my Spanish enough to do a semester. But I did London. It was easy. It's sort of easy to pop over into Europe and see so many world capitals, which I certainly did. So, yeah, of course, you have to study abroad if you can.
There you go. All of my students listening, there you go. Robert says go abroad. Now, your approach to creative marketing, I don't even know that we've talked about this so much over the past 7 years of doing this show. Do you have a particular approach when you look at a new project? Is there a patented Robert Hebert approach?
Yeah, I mean, I always like to think of the audience first.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of a nerd, so I like to know what the key performance indicators are going to be.
Nice.
It doesn't need to just be pretty. It has to get the point across and inspire people to take an action. But I really think pretty is an important place to spend a lot of time. And now when you're creating, for example, a campaign and you have the KPIs, you also have to think about the just hundreds and hundreds of different formats and contexts where the creative is going to appear. It's not overwhelming, but you do these days have to be more flexible than ever when you're sort of honing in on concepts and imagery.
Nice.
That's what you mean.
The Senior Director of Audience Development and Consumer Marketing, does that even fit on one business card?
Oh my God, yeah, it does break to two lines. You never want that, but yeah, it does. I know, it's a lot of words. I'm somebody who's comfortable wearing a lot of hats, but I'll tell you basically what I do for Hear Media. I do audience development, which means attracting people to our media brands, and those brands are Out.com and Out Magazine, Advocate.com and Advocate Magazine, Here Television, SheWired, Pride.com, which we launched in May of 2015 and is super great and I'm really excited about. And then we also have a magazine called HIV Plus. We rebranded it to Plus, and the website is HIVPlusMag.com. So those are the main brands in our portfolio. So growing those audiences, and then I execute our partnerships, which are super important. And it's, you know, this media company is just by virtue of existing and creating all of the great content for LGBTs, kind of giving back to the community. But we, by virtue of having so much media space, are able to offer a lot of that space and provide media and marketing support to nonprofit organizations that are also serving this community. So I'm the guy who goes out there and identifies who are the great national partners that you know, we can collaborate with to make a difference and help pursue their agendas. So some of those partners are like GLAAD, which would be no surprise, the LA LGBT Center, the New York LGBT Center, and then various prides. The latest partnership that I've developed and I'm really excited about is True Colors Fund. True Colors Fund helps with LGBT homeless youth, and their work is on two fronts. They're really effective at lobbying in D.C. to help get passed legislation that will improve the lives of LGBT homeless youth. And then also they manage a shelter. So working on different fronts, they're really making a difference for LGBT homeless youth. And I think that's something that we all should be concerned about. And I think that's a problem that particularly, at least our audience, has the ability to, through their generosity, to make a huge difference with.
Absolutely. We're going to dive more into the work in a second. But first, do you get a particular something, I'll keep it as general as that, in working specifically with LGBT content?
I have to say that I kind of knew early on LGBT content was going to be in my future. As like a young teenager in Rochester, New York, I would go to a bookstore that had a magazine stand that was partially filled with some gay publications, a couple of which were The Advocate magazine and Out magazine, and then a few others, which probably I was too scared to open. They would have given me an eyeful. But those publications really inspired me out in The Advocate and showed me that there was a real life out there to be lived, a rich and a full and a vibrant life with culture and music and art, design, and fashion. And if I really think if I hadn't come across Out and The Advocate at the Village Green Bookstore in 1991, I'm not sure things would have worked out so well for me. It really made a difference to have to see and have access to LGBT culture in print. And so, you know, fast forward so many years, this company who owns those brands just launched Pride.com, which creates LGBT content for young millennials, folks who are maybe 14 to their mid-20s. And that brand, which I helped launch, creates really shareable sort of social media savvy content that can populate the feeds of young LGBTs who are just discovering what it means to be LGBT and eager to share that with their allies and friends on social media. So, yeah, being a part of LGBT content, for me, it's such a privilege, but also to get to work with these brands that are so important and, you know, some of which that have stood the test of time. It's an honor.
Yeah. Folks, if they want, can stroll on over to theshowisogay.com. And if you scroll back to last May, you have our chat with Levi Chambers of Pride.com, where I distinctly recall feeling extraordinarily old. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Oh, my gosh. He does that to me all the time.
Yeah. It wasn't a good feeling. It wasn't a good feeling. What brought you to Here Media?
Great question. Well, before I was at Here Media, I was working at Forbes, where I was a promotional designer initially, and then sort of rose through the design ranks to become associate creative director of Forbes Digital. I wanted to kind of take everything I was doing and bring in more points of passion. And so when I went back into the job market, I tried to find a role that involved everything that I was doing, but that maybe was in a different niche of publishing. And luckily enough, I knew John Barrett, who was the editor-in-chief of The Advocate magazine at that time, and an opportunity came up on the careers site of HearMedia.com, and yeah, I got the job.
Nice. We like when people get the job.
I get it.
I talked in the intro about this partnership with Vimeo. Tell everybody about that.
Oh, this is really cool. It's about being empowered to make the content that we want and to get paid for it. So how about that? Yeah, Vimeo is emerging as not just a place to sort of dump your video. They now have an on-demand offering. And so what we're doing with Vimeo is we are releasing our new films and potentially in the future we'll be releasing new series directly to Vimeo for, I think it's a 60-day exclusive window. And during that window, you can download, you can buy or rent the content. And it's just a really easy and new way to consume content. And for us, it's an opportunity to reach an even wider audience for Hear TV. Hear TV, you may know, is a cable network. And it launched in 2002. It's on every cable operator in the country, so it's available in around 50 million homes. But we're looking to expand and reach larger and larger audiences where they spend time. And
yeah.
Now more than ever, they're not in front of the TV. They're on their devices. So partnering with Vimeo on the first release, which is Hush Up, Sweet Charlotte, it's pretty exciting for us.
Again, listeners, we are here with Robert Hebert, the Senior Director of Audience Development and Consumer Marketing for Hear Media. Robert, I keep seeing this phrase, quality LGBT programming, and I'm quite intrigued by that phrase. How do we go about determining what is quality LGBT programming?
Yes, I guess part of me wants to distinguish between the kind of programming that the LGBT audience gets that sort of reflects the LGBT experience, and then the kind of programming that we try to create through Hear TV. We poll our audience on a regular basis, and they frequently tell us that they love seeing all of these new gay characters and lesbian characters on mainstream shows and even on shows on Netflix. But what they really love is to participate in consuming shows where all the characters connect with the LGBT experience. And we just don't have queer shows coming from NBC or on Hulu or on Netflix. We've had a couple of all-gay series from HBO, but they have definitely been criticized as not feeling authentic. And so here TV is really obsessed with authenticity right now, creating content that resembles the lives of a more diverse LGBT audience. So when we think about quality, we think about authenticity. We think about, well, the question we ask ourselves is this show we're thinking about, is this a show that only Hear TV could make?
Yeah. How do you approach attracting audiences? I know that's a big piece of what you do. What are some successes that you feel you've had with attracting audiences, and what are the challenges in that?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the success of attracting audience to Pride.com.
Yeah.
I think it really began with the research for us. We did some research on the market, and we identified that young LGBTs didn't have a media brand that they loved, that they felt reflected their experience. And they weren't really comfortable sharing LGBT content from other sources in their feeds. And because we kind of think of content as identity equity, here at Hear Media, we feel like if young LGBTs don't have content to share in their social feeds to kind of substantiate who they are and what they care about and what they're excited and passionate about, that's a real problem. So we devised the brand and the content strategy, which was to be shareable, to be uplifting, to be positive, to create content that was joyous and optimistic about life and revealed some truths about the LGBT experiences, but that didn't sexualize or go into that zone of commodifying a body or something of that nature. We just wanted the content to be very shareable and enjoyable and something that young LGBTs would want to transact with. And the content was really successful from the get-go. Really, Levi Chambers was really visionary and really understood what the content should be. But when the content component was successful, then we were able to build audience around it through social media, through targeting audiences on Facebook, for example, that sort of looked like our other brands' audiences, but were skewing younger.
Yeah.
I really have to thank Facebook and social media for doing a great job of providing audience insights and analytics and really empowering brands, media brands like ours, to grow and find more like-minded users. So a lot of the success in attracting an audience was knowing how to use Facebook, quite honestly.
Where do we still have to go? Are there populations that are not currently being represented in the spate of programming that we need to evolve to include?
Absolutely. And that's another component of Pride and its future, as well as Hear TVs. We believe that the trans audience segment and the bisexual audience segment are dramatically underserved. The Advocate really identifies with the importance of serving the trans community. You know, the history of The Advocate, which turns 50 next year, by the way.
Whoa.
Crazy.
Yeah.
50-year-old queer magazine. Actually, it started as a little bit of a secret newsletter that you had to sign up for. And now it's a glossy magazine. I digress. So The Advocate is really passionate about creating a lot of trans reporting and content that reflects the needs and the experience of that particular community. And I think I have to give Pride.com a lot of credit for creating entertaining content that reflects the lives of young trans people, which I don't think has been done very well or at all before. Like 10 reasons why being trans is awesome, or like stories of that nature, when they come up in your feed, they have to look kind of revolutionary, I think, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
In the bisexual community and the bisexual experience, I don't think that's very well understood, even by the LGBT community.
No, it's definitely not. And I think that there's a lot of ally building, not just in, you know, in the straight community, in the heterosexual community, but within the LGBT community, within the L's, the G's, and the B's, to even begin to understand that T experience. And so any content that you all could put out there, I think is just going to be priceless for moving the needle forward on that understanding.
You're absolutely right.
There you go. All right. Now, with this partnership with Vimeo, how do we roll this out? How do we get people involved in this and get them access to this content?
Great question. Thanks for that, because it's really helpful to me. You know, I think a lot of us have, in the past couple of years, adopted so many new video platforms. Like, I don't know about you. Do you have cable?
I do.
Do you pay for Netflix?
I do.
Do you pay for any other video service?
I pay also a little bit for Hulu because I don't like the advertisements.
Exactly. So now here we are coming at you to pay for yet another thing, which is Vimeo On Demand. And it's on demand, so you're paying to stream or to download it. So it's slightly different. But that's definitely a challenge, acquainting people with this new platform that wants a bit of your entertainment budget. So we have a huge campaign in support of Hush Up Sweet Charlotte. If you hit any of our sites, you're going to see banners and video ads for the movie, which is hysterical and a lot of fun and definitely worth watching. So we have, it's like a two-stage attack for us. Stage one, make people really interested in the content that we're putting on Vimeo. And then step two, when they get to that point when they're on Vimeo and they're interested, just push them over the edge of wanting to convert. Because you're not just paying $5 or $6 or $10 for the movie the first time you hit Vimeo. You've got to sign up. And that registration hurdle for so many people is just, that's too much.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have our work cut out for us. But it's like, that's what we're up to. We really believe in our content. We want to create awesome content for Vimeo so that our partnership works for the both of us.
Fantastic. How do you determine at the end of the day, Robert, if this has been a successful outing?
Oh, gosh. Oh, is that like a philosophical question?
No, these are like your metrics. I thought you love your metrics where you get to decide is what's successful.
We always set our metrics high, which is great because it means we're working as hard as we possibly can to achieve the metrics. I think I want the biggest reach possible for all of our endeavors. I think all of the content that all of our brands are creating deserve an audience, and I believe the content that we're creating is really, really the best for LGBT audiences. So it's never enough.
Okay. Do you want to do the philosophical question? How does Robert know at the end of the day if he has been successful?
Oh my gosh, the comments. You know, you should never read the comments, but definitely the comments. When people say, I love Hushabsu Charlotte, this is the best movie I've seen this year, that feels somehow more rewarding than, like, hitting the sales numbers.
Yeah.
And then recently we got an email from a very young reader of Pride.com that shared with us what it meant to have this website in their life and how uplifting it was for them. That, like, for everyone on the editorial side and the business side, we all had to read that email and just sort of just take it in. Like, this is important work that we do. We're not, you know, we may be saving lives, maybe not every day. We're creating content that's entertaining and informational, and that's great. But, you know, we work a little harder. Maybe we don't make quite as much money as other folks in other pockets of media, but we make a difference, and that's what gets us up in the morning.
Yeah. Is there a degree to which, and we certainly have covered this with some of your colleagues from Here Media who have been on the show in years past, what does it mean to be on a service that people have to pay for as opposed to, you know, an NBC, an ABC, you know, something that people could just flip on and access? What does it allow you to do, but does that also have some challenges that go along with it?
Yeah, definitely the challenge when you have to pay $8 for Here TV, I think, is an expectation, I suppose.
Yeah.
You can watch a lot of great content now. It's the golden age of television. You can just turn on any network, and suddenly TV's better than it's ever been, right? So when Here TV says, okay, we're going to provide you with original series and original films as well as a huge collection of award-winning films and short films at $8 a month, you come with the expectation that all of that content is going to be of better quality or higher quality than what you would find elsewhere for free, but they're just the model for LGBT video content doesn't necessarily support the kind of huge budgets that, for example, an NBC Universal might have for a show. But it's you know, it goes back to being able to create content that's very authentic and original, unique, that you can't find anywhere else, and so when you do support, for example, Here TV, and you do contribute, I guess, your $8 a month, you are helping that content get created and then reach a wider audience.
There you go. You got to support these endeavors. For all the folks who are sitting on the sidelines complaining that this material is not out there, it is out there, but we actually have to engage in the process of supporting it in order to continue the creation of new content. It strikes me that's how this works.
That really is how this works. I mean, I just want to talk about, for 2 seconds, the fact that, sure, Here TV has an array of award-winning LGBT films. When's the last time you went and saw an LGBT film in a theater?
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, there aren't even theaters anymore that are carrying these movies. So the model has really dropped out for queer cinema. Outside of film festivals, there's no place to get that content. And so that's what Here TV does. We support these filmmakers who are creating these queer films that can't find an audience in theaters because marketing and driving bus to seats is too expensive. So we're creating a space that supports this content and the future of this content. So if we can keep growing the space and growing audience in the space, we can continue to support more LGBT content getting made.
Fantastic. Where should all of our listeners go to learn more about all the great things happening over at Here Media?
Oh my gosh, it's a long list of websites, I'm going to be honest with you. But, you know, I can save you some time. Go to HereMedia.com and click around. That'll just give you an array of logos that represent our media brands, and you can start your journey there.
I love it. I love it. Robert, you guys are doing pretty important work out there, putting out content that other folks are not putting out. And we don't talk about it nearly enough. Even if we talked about it all the time, it wouldn't be nearly enough for all of those folks who just, for so many different reasons, do not have access to LGBTQ culture, for whom all of the various brands associated with Hear Media provide them with that access. It is an absolute lifeline. Yes, there's entertainment for those of us who, you know, have the privilege to and the means to interact with the LGBTQ community, but for folks in other areas, it's a lifeline for them. So you guys are doing pretty darn important work over there.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. You get to keep your last name now that I have mastered it, and we look forward to seeing so much more from Hear Media in the future.
Love it.
All right, folks, and we are back with our second amazing guest for this week's episode. Let me introduce her. Bryn Tannehill is an author, a veteran, a scientist, an advocate, and so much more. She graduated from the Naval Academy with a BS in computer science in 1997. She earned her naval aviator wings in 1999. She served as a campaign analyst while deployed overseas to the 5th Fleet headquarters in Bahrain from 2005 to 2006. In 2008, Bryn began working as a senior defense research scientist in private industry. She then left the drilling reserves and began transition in 2010. Since then, she has written for The Huffington Post, OutServe Magazine, The New Civil Rights Movement, and Queer Mental Health as a blogger and a featured columnist, and now she is here with us. Bryn, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing darn well. We're so excited to have you, Bryn. We have so much ground to cover.
All right. So let's get started.
Let's get started. Bryn, I'm trying to get past the sentence, she earned her naval aviator wings in 1999. Do you just wake up in the morning and say, I earned my naval aviator wings? Because I would.
You know, that's one of those things that I wanted to do from the time I was about 5 or 6 years old, is be a pilot. And, you know, that's something that no matter what, no one can ever take away from me, is that I earned my wings of gold. And that's one of those things that, you know, that's bucket list material.
Oh my gosh. In one of perhaps the biggest understatements in 7 years of doing this show, it strikes me that it was probably a lot of work to earn your naval aviator wings.
It was a long-term plan from when I was in seventh grade. I knew I wanted to go to the Naval Academy. I had two uncles who went to West Point. And I knew that was, for a poor kid from Phoenix, Arizona, that was probably my best ticket to a college education and a chance to fly. So, I mean, through high school, it was, everything was geared towards getting into the Naval Academy. And then I went to the Naval Academy, and everything I did there was geared towards getting a pilot billet. And then it was 2 years of flight school in order to get my naval aviator wings and be able to fly helicopters operationally for the Navy.
You realize that there is not a conversation that you could not trump by saying, well, that's great, but I earned my naval aviator wings.
I think some people have a little bit on me there, but it's definitely one of those things that not a lot of people have done. And as much as I hate to say it, it's something I'm proud of.
I'm proud just even reading that sentence. So it's so incredible. You know, as I was preparing questions and looking over your background and having done so many interviews on this show, one of the things that popped out at me is that not every guest on this show, Bryn, is in the position where they have to tell their personal story in order to talk about the work that they do. And it strikes me in looking at interviews that you've done, you know, so much of it is tied to your own narrative. Do you get tired of telling your own story? Is it invigorating for you? Is there a degree to which you wish you could do the work without it being connected there? Talk to me about that personal narrative piece.
Well, I think for trans activists, a lot of times we're expected to talk about our own personal narratives. And I've actually written in The Advocate a number of times about how I try and take my advocacy away from my personal narrative,
yeah.
That I try and stick to the facts, that I try and stick to the science, that I try and stick to debunking right-wing narratives, that this isn't about me. This is about getting the right information out there. This is about getting better information out there. This is about calling out injustice and hypocrisy directed towards trans people. So yes, some of my story comes out, but I think less of it comes out and less is given than for a lot of other trans activists who make their story their central theme of their advocacy, whereas my advocacy is much more centered around law and policy and science.
Yeah, you are a scientist. That's a background that I do not have, Bryn. That's a specialty right there.
Well, I wouldn't say scientist is more applied mathematics or applied statistics.
That's a real thing, Bryn. I can't do that.
Well, I think it's fun, but that also makes me a rather sick individual.
So how would you characterize kind of the state of the movement right now? How are we doing in moving away from those narratives and getting towards the facts?
Well, that's one of the problems that we have, is that right now the biggest issues facing not just the transgender community, but the movement as a whole are relying on visceral reactions to transgender people and stirring up feelings of disgust and anger and fear directed to trans people. And once people get in that state, they've looked at this psychologically, once people get to a position where they're feeling fearful and having some sort of flight or fight reaction, the logical centers of the brain just turn off.
Yeah.
People are not making rational decisions at that point, which is making our jobs as advocates and activists much, much harder. Because when you look at the facts of things like transgender people in bathrooms, transgender people do not assault people in bathrooms. That
right.
is just not a thing that happens. And here's the other thing, too, is that there really aren't any cases of people pretending to be transgender in order to do it. And you can't reason with people and say, how do you tell the difference between someone who's early in transition from someone pretending, which neither of which happens. But honestly, when people look at that, you know, it puts trans people in danger because people have been told over and over and over again, fear people who look transgender because they will do bad things to you in bathrooms. So what they're going to end up doing is nobody pretends to be transgender, but you have real transgender people, and you're going to have transgender people getting beaten in bathrooms. And
yeah.
This is exactly what happened 2013 with Missy Polis.
Yeah. Obviously, there's no magic bullet to any of this. Have you found that there's a consistent, solid starting point that at least grounds the conversation for people who clearly need much more education than they currently have?
I think the starting point usually is personal conversations.
Yeah.
We have very out people who are very visible public figures like Caitlyn Jenner, but that only tells a very small portion of the story, and Caitlyn Jenner certainly doesn't represent the majority of trans experiences, which tend to be a lot darker, a lot poorer, and a lot more to lose. I mean, even at the end of the day, Caitlyn Jenner will have millions and millions of dollars, even if nobody pays her anything ever again.
Right.
The rest of us, if we lose our jobs and disappear, well, we don't have that much money to fall back on to spend the rest of our lives leaning on to get us through. So our struggles tend to be a lot more visceral, a lot more dangerous. Most of us don't live in places where there are any legal protections. And that means that we have a lot of skin in the game. And you know, most people have not met a transgender person.
Yeah.
A lot of statistics say it's as low as 16%, which is kind of ironic because 18% of Americans say they've met a ghost.
Is that a thing? Wow.
That's actually, more Americans believe they've seen a ghost than know that they've met a transgender person.
Wow. I don't even think I can wrap my mind around that one. Well, as we covered on last week's show, we talked a little bit about the anti-transgender student bill in South Dakota, and that inspired you to write this new piece for the Huffington Post, and then they came for transgender people. What triggered you to sit down and pen something new?
Well, I write a lot.
Yeah.
So me being inspired to write something new is a fairly common occurrence.
Nice.
But this one in particular, I decided to be as provocative as possible because this is something where there is a lot at stake here and there's a lot of risk. Last year, the Family Research Council, a anti-LGBT hate group with millions and millions of dollars, they're several times larger than the task force, and they're almost as large as HRC, put out a position paper that basically laid out a 5-point plan for how to remove transgender people from public life, to make it virtually impossible for transgender people to exist in American society, and to do so via legislation and legal regulation of transgender people's lives. And this is effectively a form of cultural genocide.
Yeah.
The idea is to make life as a transgender person so impossible to live that we will self-deport back to the closet, or we will cease to exist. We cannot be unable to function, be able to find homes or housing or get educations or use bathrooms or do anything within American society. And that's a pretty heinous plan.
Mm-hmm.
It's also it's pretty sinister. And the ultimate goal is one that is absolutely despicable. And I think it needs to be brought up that the bathroom bills and the other bills that are being put out there, 44 at last count according to the Human Rights Campaign, and 30 plus according to the article written by me and Allison Gill for The Advocate, almost all of them are geared towards enacting the Family Research Council's plan for transgender people, which is to remove us from public life.
Yeah, and you wrote this question, which will just stick with anyone who reads the piece. You wrote, now, who will speak up and when? Which, of course, Bryn, begs the question, do you think our national organizations are doing enough to speak up at all the times that we need them to speak up?
So that's a complicated question.
We could probably do a few weeks just on that question alone.
So the answer is, it's complicated.
Yes.
Some organizations like Lambda Legal and the ACLU, and Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund. These, and GLAAD, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, which has now just changed its name. But these are legal organizations. They don't do ground game kinds of things.
Right.
They can file amicus briefs. They can challenge these laws in court. But they can speak to political officials and tell them, yeah, if you do this, you're going to court. But that's essentially a reactionary kind of plan.
Right.
National organizations have struggled to figure out how to engage on trans issues at times because it's tough to raise money on trans issues. There's a lot also, I'll be brutally honest, there's a lot of gay donors who really aren't that interested in trans issues.
Yeah.
Or there are people who are hostile to trans issues. As with what happened with the Equality Federation, Equality Michigan organization a couple years ago. So sticking up for trans people for national organizations is tough, both financially and in terms of what membership is looking for. I mean, the trans community is only 10% of the LGBT population.
Right.
However, we're the ones bearing the brunt of the conservative backlash after the Obergefell decision, you know, in favor of marriage equality. You know, and this is a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I was saying if organizations didn't have a plan to shift from a marriage focus to trans issues, that we weren't going to be prepared for this kind of backlash. And that's come to pass. So the good news is I think that national organizations are fully aware of this. They're fully aware of what's at stake. That I know for a fact that a lot of really, really smart organizations that do messaging and research on movement issues are looking at this deeply and figuring out what the counter messaging is. And I think we're very, very close to having an effective counter message to a lot of this fear mongering. I can't really say the word baloney.
Yeah.
So I'll say baloney.
Yeah.
And we'll be able to challenge that going forward. And in a lot of ways, I think that this is probably a last gasp. What we're seeing is this is 1977 for transgender people. Looking back at the kinds of laws that they tried to pass to prevent gay people from being educators back in the 70s. And this is kind of where we're going with trans people.
One of the biggest enemies of all of our progress, every time we try to take a step forward, complacency is just a killer for us. And I think we certainly see complacency with working towards trans equality after the Supreme Court decision, because everyone thinks, oh, everything's great now. And it strikes me one of the other areas that we have seen a ton of complacency is with the military, with the elimination of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Well, then everything's great in the military for LGBT individuals. And that is still not the case, correct, Bryn?
And that's the case. I mean, and that was a common misconception. Dan Savage went on MSNBC the day after that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed and was asked if this affected transgender people. And he said, oh, yeah, sure, it definitely does. Well, no, it doesn't, actually. The laws against transgender people, it's not a law. It's actually a medical policy still there. The good news is that we're moving forward on this, that the Pentagon has had a working group in session producing recommendations to the Secretary of Defense on how to move forward on open transgender service. And the goal of this working group was to figure out not just if it was possible, but how to make it happen, with the starting assumption that it is possible, given that we've got 18 of our closest allies who have already implemented open service for transgender people. And I think the recommendations that will be coming out in the next few months, and the policy that comes out in the next few months, is going to be very favorable, and that we're going to be happy with it. And that's the other thing, too, is the Obama administration has been a tremendous friend to the transgender community, quietly, but we've never had a better president on these issues, including things like allowing transgender people to get passports with their correct gender markers much more easily, and not requiring surgery, which most trans people can't afford or simply don't want for most transgender men.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with author, scientist, advocate, Bryn Tannehill. Bryn, let me get your reflections on some names. I'll throw some names out at you, and you tell me what you think based on some of your writing. I loved reading these pieces. Just a
Thank
couple
you.
Names. Bryn, Ted Cruz, go.
Hangs out with Kill the Gays pastors.
Yeah.
Scary.
Really scary. It's not just like, oh, let's scoff. Ted Cruz, a little bit scary.
A lot scary. Given his one interaction on the campaign trail with a lesbian woman who challenged on his gay rights issues, his response was essentially, it's not discrimination unless we're throwing you off of buildings like ISIS. Count your blessings.
Oh, boy. I liked when he just looked the one woman in the face and said, yeah, no, I would totally deport you. So that was a really lovely moment on the campaign trail as well.
Yeah. Special snowflakes.
Special. We'll go with that. Let's talk about another, but really special snowflakes. How about David Bowie?
Oh, God, that hurt.
Yeah.
David Bowie. I wrote an article about David Bowie, and a person who was very close to me shared her love of David Bowie and how he challenged gender norms and how he made queer and genderqueer and androgynous beautiful, and how he was so far ahead of his time in music. You can listen to just about anything David Bowie wrote and performed, and if you listen to it outside of the context of knowing when it was done, you'll invariably hear motifs in it that were 3, 4, 5 years ahead of everything else in music. So, I mean, he was a queer icon, and rightfully so. He helped me understand that queer is beautiful, and he was a musician that was always ahead of his time, every time, and even his last album that he released was kind of a farewell album that people didn't even know was a farewell album. And so, I mean, even to the last, he was ahead of us all.
Yeah. There you go. That's David Bowie. And let me do, how about a TV show that I tried to watch and I couldn't really get into it, but you have some opinions on Pretty Little Liars.
Okay. Well, my daughter likes this more than me. But the ending with a villain who the reveal of the big bad villain is they're transgender. And I'm like, oh, God, people already think that transgender people are liars and deceivers, and that we're dangerous and we're predators. And honestly, using the whole cross-dressing and transgender thing as the big reveal to reveal the ultimate bad guy, very cliche. This goes back to like Psycho.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then there was a movie in the 80s. And then there was Ace Ventura with the big reveal and to humiliate trans people. And then there was, I mean, Silence of the Lambs. So using the big reveal that the villain is either trans or thinks they're trans or is a cross-dresser to hide their identity, it's kind of like, really, we don't need any more, horrible trans villains who are deceivers and liars. And it's not so much that I hate it in some special way. It's that they really could have done a lot better job, with the writing and avoiding cliches.
And when you banned your daughter from ever watching it again, what kind of tantrum was there?
There wasn't. She'd kind of moved on to Doctor Who anyway.
Nice. Oh, that we support.
Yes, wholehearted support for, you know, being a Doctor fan. So, by the way, which Doctor's your favorite?
Oh, I have to say that, oh my gosh, I'm totally blanking on his name. This is going to be very embarrassing for me, and this is the kind of stuff that I edit out.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't turn it around.
No, this is okay. You go first. Who is your favorite?
Oh, we're totally a 10th Doctor family.
Tell me why.
David Tennant, fantastic actor, really deep, plays both compassion and anger and vengeance all at the same time really well. You get a sense of this is a 800-year-old being who has not only committed genocide once, he's committed it twice and is living with it every damn day.
I have to say that I threw myself into Torchwood more than anything else.
We watched a little bit of that, okay. But definitely we're still going through the Capaldi years right now.
Okay. I will say that I was a 7th Doctor person, Sylvester McCoy, but I think there was just, it's just the whole approach to it. There was a certain confidence and a vulnerability. So I'm a 7th Doctor guy. Some of our listeners like, don't know what they're talking about. So,
oh God, we're turning everybody who isn't a nerd off.
Well, look, hopefully we're activating some nerds too, because there's more work to be done in that area. So it's a good thing. Let's end with some playbook for our listeners. Give us some advice. What should everybody be doing? Because I think that the basic argument, no matter how much you're active, you can always be doing a little bit more. So where's a good place for us to start? Certainly the personal conversations, as you mentioned, but where can people really start getting active and start making a real difference?
It starts out really, really simple. And that is, if you have the ability as an ally to speak out, do so. And it can be in little ways, just calling out microaggressions or making fun of trans people that you see in your daily life or at the office or among friends. The other way you can do it is if you have a little bit more authority, a little bit more power, to do things like one ally at the last company I worked for to help get trans healthcare be included in the company's benefits package. That's huge. If you don't understand trans issues, make an attempt to learn about them. There's plenty of information out there, and I can recommend my website as a starting place to read years worth of articles going over every aspect of trans law and policy and cultural issues. And there's plenty of other fantastic trans authors and writers out there in the blogosphere. Educate yourself. If you hear something, see something, say something, speak up. Because honestly, we're a small group. Big bads are coming for us. And if we try and fight this one on our own, it's not going to end well. Yeah. It never ends well, like when we're going up against people like this.
Yeah. Where can all of our listeners go to learn more about all the great things that you're doing?
So if you'd like to read all of my articles in one place, it's www.bryntannehill.com, all one word. You can follow me on Twitter. I also write most frequently for the Huffington Post and The Advocate, and you can look up my backlog of articles there. And you can also search most of those articles or my website for different transgender-related topics.
Nice. Bryn, I have to say, in most simple praise that I put out there, I love your writing. Your writing has a clarity to it. It has a clarion call to it. It pushes people to action, but it's also grounded in actual facts. And that's so appreciated. You know, there are certainly personal narrative pieces to what you're writing, but it's also grounded in, look, here's what's actually happening and here's what everyone must do. And that clarity has countless times really pushed me to learn more. And I have no doubt that it's doing the same for everybody who reads your pieces.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And it's always gratifying to know that what I write not just convinces people, not just educates people, but moves them to act.
Yeah.
And that's really what we need the most.
Action is needed. Bryn, please, please keep doing what you're doing.
I will. I'm not going anywhere.
I am sorry that I set my sights on the things I read. Something meant for your husband, maybe you left it under the bed. Once upon love, those words blew free and secret, the pages lay around.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but still a few minutes to get to the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. A new study out there causing shockwaves all over the community. Half of all Black, gay, and bisexual men in the United States are projected to be diagnosed with HIV. This is according to a government study. This is a ratio parallel to the prevalence of the virus among such men in developing nations such as Mauritania and Senegal. Black men who have sex with men are 250 times more likely as heterosexual American men overall to be diagnosed with the virus, according to the report by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Among Latino gay and bisexual men, 1 in 4 are projected to get HIV in their lifetime, and the chances of white gay and bisexual men getting HIV is 1 in 11. This is all in this report that was released this week. The figures are a reminder that efforts need to be made to boost HIV and AIDS prevention. This is according to Jonathan Merman, who's the director of the CDC's National Center for HIV and AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and Tuberculosis Prevention. He said this, quote, "Hundreds of thousands of people will be diagnosed in their lifetime if we don't scale up efforts now." Unbelievable stats, according to this research study. There's so much need out there to be having these conversations. I remember a few weeks ago, the Human Rights Campaign put out there on their Facebook page that they were doing some targeted efforts in communities of color to address HIV and AIDS. And there were so many responses from folks saying, "This is racist. Why are you separating the races? Why are you focusing on just one race?" Well, the reason is because we have an entire population out there that is completely under-resourced. We have a population out there that needs targeted efforts. We don't just put out there, well, let's just talk about gay men and bisexual men as a whole. Because obviously, according to stats like this, they're not being treated in the same way. The access to resources is not the same. So we have so much work to do with our healthcare providers, work to do in the education system. I mean, health classes all over, we need to be having different conversations, and work to do regarding PrEP so that people understand, well, this is what PrEP is and this is what PrEP can do. According to the study, the projections for gay Black men in the United States evoke the rates of HIV and AIDS in African nations such as Mauritania, where some 44% of gay and bisexual men had HIV in 2014. The same year in Senegal, nearly 42% of gay and bisexual men had the virus. In the United States, more than 1.2 million people have HIV, according to CDC data. Worldwide, some 36.9 million people were living with HIV at the end of 2014. Globally, HIV infections have been falling since AIDS-related deaths peaked in 2004. So much work to do. We need targeted efforts. We can't just put out education and resources that are for all gay men and for all bisexual men. We need targeted efforts. Because what's being put out there now is not affecting populations of color in the same way that it's affecting white populations. The stats are completely different, and to lump everyone in together is not doing the trick. So a ton of work to do there. The latest update in South Dakota. South Dakota Governor Dennis Daugaard can no longer say that he's never met a transgender person, but it remains unclear if the Republican will veto legislation that would force transgender students to use the wrong restroom and locker room at school. Dozens of transgender South Dakotans and their friends, family, and allies gathered at the state capitol this week to participate in a closed-door meeting with the governor. While the meeting was closed to members of the press, a trans board member with South Dakota's Center for Equality said the meeting went well. Kendra Heath-Scott, in a prepared statement, said this, quote, "The governor was warm and personable and wanted to be inclusive to hearing all of our stories. We are grateful that he accepted our invitation, and we asked him to veto HB 1008. The governor, who previously said he had never knowingly met a transgender person, now has until March 1st to decide whether he will sign or veto this bill. If he takes no action, the bill becomes law automatically, which would make South Dakota the first U.S. state to enact such sweeping restrictions on equal access for trans students." Come on, South Dakota. You don't want to be the first U.S. state to enact such sweeping restrictions on equal access for trans students. That's not a distinction that you want. And as opposed to some non-discrimination ordinances where people might say, well, I'm just going to move somewhere else. These are trans youth who don't have the option of just getting out and walking to another state. I hope no one's just walking to other states. But however they're getting to another state, this is a vulnerable population. This is a population at risk. And they don't have the means or the ability to just get up and leave. So we will, of course, keep you posted on what's going on in South Dakota. Huge, huge news in the conversion therapy front. Several LGBT groups have joined together to file a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission alleging that practitioners of so-called conversion therapy, which aims to change a person's sexual orientation or gender identity. The federal consumer fraud complaint was filed this week against a Virginia-based group called People Can Change, which claims that sexual orientation and gender identity can be changed through therapy and counseling. This claim has been soundly debunked. I tell you this all the time, week in, week out on this show. This claim has been soundly debunked by every major medical and psychiatric health organization in the country, while the discredited practice has been outlawed for use on minors in only, again, this is a reminder, it is only outlawed in California, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., and Oregon. That's it. California, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., and Oregon. We have this practice that is doing so much harm, and it is only outlawed in those four places. That's it. Last year, the White House and top Obama administration officials came out against conversion therapy, which received renewed attention after the public suicide note of 17-year-old Leela Alcorn right here in Ohio. This new federal complaint alleges that People Can Change and all practitioners of what is also called ex-gay therapy, quote, defrauds customers into believing that being LGBT is a mental illness or emotional defect that needs to be cured, end quote. The group's advertising of that false claim violates Section 5 of the FTC Act, which prohibits unfair and deceptive practices, according to this complaint. So this is a big deal. This is a ton of organizations coming together to hopefully make some inroads to ban conversion therapy from more than just those four places, more than just California, New Jersey, Washington, D.C., and Oregon. It's a practice that does harm. Again, these are vulnerable populations. We have to step up to do more to help them out. That's the message of this week's show. There are people that are being underserved. There are people that are being underrepresented. And if we don't use our voices to make a difference, then we're just not helping. We're putting a stamp of approval on everything that's happening. Complacency. Complacency is the enemy. And that, my friends, is it for this week's episode. Our huge, huge thanks to two incredible guests, Robert and Bear. What great work they're doing over there on Hear Media. We have to support this content. If we're not supporting this content, more of this content doesn't get made. And we all want more LGBTQ content. So let's get on it. And of course, to Bryn Tannehill, her writing really does move me. She is using her pen to make a difference. How are you making a difference? What are you doing to use your voice to lift up the voices of your LGBTQ brothers and sisters? You gotta do something. It will make a difference, and I promise you, it will make you feel so much better about yourself when you use your voice in that way that helps out others. That's the message week in and week out. Get out there, folks. Go make a difference. And while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?